Well, we've been down a long journey, and we're now at the end of it. There's so much that we could say. I mean, we've left out a lot. So this isn't a comprehensive view of the history of human thought for a couple of reasons. One, we don't have all the information that we need, especially the further that we go back, and also because there's just not enough time to deal with it all. And there's lots and lots of details that explain lots of things, and I hope that this will be for you a springboard to exploring some of those things more, where you have questions about things, to look in the direction of those questions and seek those things out. Why is it that people think the way they do? Why is it that people behave the way they do in church and in the world? You know, we're always asking that question. Why does everybody act so strange? You know, especially when you're out on the highway somewhere in traffic or whatever, then, you know, which, you know, there's the temptation to think that there should be a 30-second chapter of Proverbs just for traffic, you know, just to show, you know, the fool in traffic, you know, things of that sort. And, that kind of got left out, or no, it didn't, but, one of the things that we're noting in the world that's around us is the buildup of irrationality. And Christian philosophers, the true Christian philosophers who really are seeing things from a biblical perspective, have been talking about this for a long time. The tensions between rationality and irrationality that take place between a belief in the absolutes of Scripture and more and more of a drift away from that into relativism, which, as we saw with relativism, I hope I illustrated that well enough, how irrational it is. The idea that that parity between the object and the experience, that never bothered us when we were children. You know, when we saw the cookie, it was an exterior object which we very quickly made a part of our experience because of the fact that we perceived it correctly for what it was. And didn't question whether that was true or not, or what the nature of the cookie was, or whether or not its edges were really truly in focus, or whether they were sort of blurry and part of the surrounding ether. You know, I mean, that's not something that children spend a lot of time contemplating. They're mainly wondering whether or not they can get away with it. So it's more of a legal question, really, than it is a philosophical one in the long run. But because it's ridiculous, it's irrational. The irrationality factor of it is worse than just being ridiculous, though. I mean, Albert Camus goes there, absurdism. But it goes beyond Camus. It goes from Camus through Jean-Paul Sartre to Nietzsche. And that is to say, this idea of relativism and existentialism and nihilism is not just crazy. It's dangerous. It's terribly dangerous. And what we're seeing is the outworking of the end of human thought, of the heart of man. We're seeing the outworking of the heart of man, which is what? What does the Bible say that the end thereof is? It's the way of death. And so we are arriving there in what is being called the postmodern age. I'm not a big fan of that term, by the way, because in the first place, all ages are modern ages until they pass on into the past. And so there is no such thing as a postmodern age, and that's just going to be confusing for people about 500 years from now who are going to go, well, what are we? You know, I mean, we can't be modern anymore. you know, everything goes backwards from here. I don't know. But so we need to call it what it really is. And it is the age of nihilism. We have entered into that. I don't think that man can be perfectly nihilistic without just the self-destruction of the entire human race. We definitely are seeing that. Some of the early existentialists made this claim, and in fact, I think it was made of Sartre, who in his life, he propagated the existential idea that, and what existentialism means is that it is what it is. All right, I mean, that's really existentialism in a nutshell. You hear people say that a lot too these days. It is what it is, and sometimes they say it right, and there's no problem with that. But you know, you have to wonder, has that kind of eked in there? Because basically, what's happened is that philosophy has ceased to be an inquiry into things, a quest for truth or a quest for knowledge or a quest for system. And it has now turned on itself. Philosophy has turned on itself. Philosophies now are philosophies of philosophy. They're philosophies about, why do we even bother? why are we doing this? Why are we going to all this mental trouble and everything? I mean, is there any really good reason to do this? Because if rationalism, relativism, empiricism, and everything leads to uncertainty, no absolutes, no boundaries, no focus, the breakdown of reality itself, then the next step naturally is going to be meaning itself. Meaning, essence, value, purpose. Those kinds of things are now on the front lines to be assailed by human thought. And that's where we are. We're at a place where philosophy has turned upon the very goal of philosophy and is past asking the question whether or not we're going to find out things. Now it's like, we're not ever going to be able to know anything for certain, and what's the use in trying? Because there's nothing there. There isn't anything there. Now, there's a part of the soul of man that will never accept that. But if we follow our philosophy to its logical end, that's where it's going to take us. And we cannot avoid that. And I think we're at a place where philosophy recognizes that the end of this is going to be nothing. This is going to be nothingness. And that's the name of a book by Jean-Paul Sartre, which was written at the turn of the century. It was called Being and Nothingness. And basically what it is it is a it's an essay on a kind of a narrative essay on being in existence and yet having no ability to escape it, and that it's not going anywhere and it's not taking you anywhere. It's just nothing. Charles Ives followed up that view in a composition that he did at the turn of the century called The Unanswered Question. And you know, the woodwind is calling out, I think it's actually the lonely trumpet that's calling out the question, why am I here? And the orchestra comes in with this cacophony of not music, just sound, just noise. And over and over again, all at the same time trying to answer the question, but none of them have any answer to the question at all. And in the end, the question fades on out into, you know, the sort of drifting strings that have run all the way through it, which represent, the eternal nothing out there. And it's a great illustration, really, of what Sartre is talking about, that there is no meaning, there is no purpose, there is no value. it's totally logical that all philosophies will go in this direction. Hinduism did. What's the ultimate end of Hinduism? Nirvana. And nirvana is nothingness. It is the vast monad. And that monad is where everything is all one. Finally, we come to the irreducible principle. And what is the irreducible principle? Because we've really known what it was all along. It's nothing. Nothing is the irreducible principle. You can't get any more reduced than that. Right? And ultimately, human thought systems, when they are taken to their extreme end, are going to come to that nothingness. And why not? That was what we came from. And that is what we will always return to apart from God. Only God can sustain existence. Only God can sustain existence not only in its substance, but also in its essence. Only God can put purpose and definition in things and sustain that purpose and definition. All right? When man tries it on his own, he's futile. He cannot do it. Why? Because man was not made to give himself definition. Man was not made to give himself meaning, purpose, and value. Man was made to receive it from a creator. Only the creator can give these things to us. We can't have them on our own. We're not capable of having them on our own. And so there's, in the end, when we depart from Him and when we depart from His Word and from His law and from the absolute principles that He lays down before us, having revealed these to us by His Spirit, when we depart from these things, there's no escape. There is no escape and there is no meaning. We are just existing and not really quite sure of that. We're just in an altered state. An altered state of existence. And the interesting thing about it is that the whole concept of the altered state or the transcendental principle brings us right back to where we started. That we begin to hallucinate everything that's around us. And we begin to imagine a reality that is only within our heads. And we begin to create out of nothing a world of our own making in which we are the center because we are the aware one. And what have we done? We've gone all the way back to the first rebellion again. I mean, that's where mythology began, wasn't it? It began with a rebellion against God in which man, in the one sanctum sanctorum that he thought that he had, is now going to recreate the world out of nothing. In the virtual reality of the mind and the imagination. And what does it lead to in the end? It leads to where we are in the danger of being. Nothingness. All right? Nihilism. No ability whatsoever to be able to say what the value is of anything or whether or not there is a value to anything. Now, when we get to this point, where are we? We're in a very, very dangerous position. Because the one thing that keeps order is value. Well, I mean, the principle that keeps order is value. All right, God is the one who keeps order. But the principle of value keeps order. How does it do that? It does it because we treasure things. Because of the value of a thing, we want to preserve it, to protect it, and to keep it. Strip the value out of it, and what do? Throw it away. Throw it on the ground. Destroy it. Get rid of it. Disregard it. Not take it into consideration in any way. What does that apply to? Well, it applies to a lot more than 2,000-year-old brass Roman coins. It applies to human beings, individual human beings, how we treat one another. When we're nihilistic, why should we treat each other well? Why should we regard one another's person? After all, I'm the only one that counts. And I'm not really sure whether you're actually even there. And so therefore, why should I value you? Why should I protect you? Why should I regard you and respect you? There's no good reason for it. And so society begins to break apart at its elemental stage. And this is going to grow and grow, tearing society and societies apart until civilization itself folds in on itself. What about people, human beings in particular? What's the value of the human race? I mean, we can say that the human race is going somewhere in progress. And you're going to run into people who are going to say, evolution, yay. Everything's getting better and going up as far as the autonomous man and his self-awareness and how he is taking his destiny in his own hand and all that kind of stuff is concerned. And what you need to do is you need to ask this question. So what? What does that matter? Well, we're human. We're human beings. So, what's valuable about that? Well, there's a lot of us, you know. Well, wouldn't this planet be better off of that? You know, and I think the environmentalists have really kind of started to step over that line, too, to where they're weighing the value of the totality of nature and man and his place in it, and they're going, you know what? Man is the enemy. We need to get him out of the picture. The world would be a lot better off if the dinosaurs were still ruling the earth. All right, and so it's the nature itself, it's the creation itself, it's the environment that is now important, not the inhabitant. The inhabitant is meaningless, and maybe even a little worse than meaningless, kind of destructive. What's the difference between, and this is where we get into situation ethics, what's the difference between one object and another one ontologically? I mean, what's the difference? And we can say, well, you know, this thing, this biped right here is a human being, and this thing with roots in the ground is a tree. And we might be able to see the apparent difference, but what about the essence? What about the value? What is it that makes the biped more important than the tree? And philosophy cannot answer that question because everything is just chemicals in motion. And the chemicals of a human being in motion are essentially no different from the chemicals of a tree in motion. And so if we want to preserve the tree because of good environmental purposes, then it behooves us to preserve the tree. But if we want to kill the human for environmental purposes, then we need to kill the human. Because the human is in the way of the tree. All right? And we're coming into this more and more. This is becoming more and more the mindset here. It's not a matter of, it just makes sense to take place of our planet, okay? Man has always known that it makes sense to take care of our planet. This is about value. This is about what has value, what has meaning, what has purpose. And if we blast the value and the meaning of everything, which we do by total across the board egalitarianism, make everything equal and you make everything meaningless. All right? Then, having done that, what does that do to our ethical system? Our ethical system becomes totally dependent upon a set of circumstances that somebody judges to be desirable. Let me say that again. Our value system becomes completely, our ethical system becomes completely dependent upon a circumstantial system, a circumstantial condition that somebody has got to judge is desirable for everybody. And who is that somebody going to be? Well, that somebody is going to be the great expert pragmatist. Because that's probably the last link in the chain of modern philosophy. And in my opinion, what utilitarianism and pragmatism are, and they rule our day. Make sure you understand that. You know, we've talked about rationalism, and you may know a couple of rationalists here and there, but you don't see rationalism going off all over everywhere, or even empiricism. You know, we see a lot of that, and a lot more of that, but we don't see it everywhere. But I'll tell you one thing we see pragmatism constantly, all the time. It has crept into everything. And it's not really truly a philosophy. It's an anti-philosophy. It basically says, because what does philosophy do? Philosophy seeks, by certain tools, to seek a meaning. All right? I mean, that's what it claims. It's not, you know, it's never going to be true to that, but it claims that it's in a quest to try to find meaning, to try to find purpose, to try to find out what a thing is, what systems of things are, and why we're here and where we're going and all of these kind of things. This is what philosophy tries to do. Pragmatism doesn't try to do that. Pragmatism is there to prove that something is good, whatever you want to call that, because goodness is not, you know, the pragmatist view of goodness is not a view of absolute ethic. You know, this is good, this is evil. Pragmatists aren't looking for that. Because remember, we're being told this all the time. You know, we don't want to mix morals into things. That's a pragmatist view. Pragmatists don't want to mix morals into anything. Don't mix morals into law. Don't mix morals into lawmaking. Don't mix morals into politics. Don't mix morals into judicial litigation. Don't mix morals into any of these things. Keep morals out of the picture all the time. It's not about good and evil anymore. Good is now defined as that which is functional in a context. All right? And so what pragmatism is it is a system of thought that's supposed to take us step by step from one set of circumstances to another, seeking the functional in each one of those systems. And the functional is the thing that's going to be good. All right? Now, you can argue with the pragmatist and you can say, look, the functional thing you just put here right now, great, that's very functional. I'm glad you like it and everything. But that's not going to be too good in this set of conditions, which is going to come. He's going to say, who cares? We're not worried about that. We're worried about this. This is going to lead to that. And then we figure that out, and that's going to lead to that. And we'll figure that out, and that'll lead to that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where's it going to end? Nobody knows. Nobody cares. It just keeps moving. And that's the main thing. It isn't a quest for meaning anymore. It's a quest for continual animation. Just keep moving, keep moving, keep moving. It's almost like, you know, the philosophers started out going across the desert and they were all enthusiastic about it. All right, we're going to get out of here and cross this desert. All right. And then after a while they get tired and they're like, whoa, sure is tiring out here. It's really hot. And then after a while, they're thirsty and they're going, wow, we're really thirsty now and we're running out of water. Finally, they have gotten to the point to where it's just keep plodding, keep plodding, keep plodding, keep plodding. All right. That's where we are right now. Philosophically, we're just in the plodding mode. Just keep going, keep going, keep going. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have meaning. It doesn't have purpose. It doesn't have value. It doesn't matter. Just keep walking. Keep proving you're alive. And it's always dressed in terms this is for the good of the many. What we're doing here is for the good of the many. And that's about as close to a moral as it gets, because it's still hooked on to utilitarianism, which is what pragmatism came out of. It's still hooked on to Jeremy Bentham and hasn't quite let him loose yet. All right. There'll probably come a time when it'll be like, well, what's the difference between the good of the many and the good of the few? What difference does that make? Because if we're going to go and evaluate things and weigh anything in the value, somewhere down the line, it's not going to make any difference anymore. Save the one. Let a million die. You know, who cares? We can flip this any way we want to. It all depends on what's best for the circumstances. I'm going to give you what I believe is the supreme example of what we're talking about in the 20th century. And that is the Manhattan Project. If you get into the boardroom discussions in the Manhattan Project, that is one of the most fascinating things from a philosophical perspective that you're going to see. Because I think that the scientists were way ahead of the philosophers in this plotting mode. Okay? But in World War II, it was discovered that up in Norway, the Germans were producing heavy water, deuterium, and which is something that is necessary in the processes of nuclear fission. And having discovered this, and it was British intelligence that discovered it. You know, they concluded that the Germans were working on an atom bomb. And they held on to that knowledge until the Americans joined, and then the British intelligence told the United States military about it. So the U.S. military decided, well, we're going to have to outrun them on this. The British were not going to be able to do that. They were trying, but they weren't getting anywhere. What we didn't know and could have found out if we had sent more intelligence in there was that the Germans abandoned the project almost immediately after they started it. Hitler was totally against nuclear physics because he considered it Jewish science. And it wouldn't have been hard to pick up that little piece of information. But once the term deuterium came out, it was like, we're in a race now for the doomsday machine. And so the United States put together the Manhattan Project, which worked out, first tried to work out nuclear fusion, but found out that was more difficult to do, and then turned to nuclear fission, and moved to Alamogordo, New Mexico, to get a device ready for testing. And so you had this incredible assembly of nuclear physicists and technicians and so forth who were working this whole thing out in the military. A very secret project. And then finally they built the device, a nuclear fission bomb. And the question came, just how powerful is this thing going to be? And the estimation on the power of it was between 1,700 tons TNT. That's the output that we're expecting out of this thing, okay? Which is a huge explosion. You know, it's like 1,500 tons of dynamite going off at the same time. Just a great big explosion, enough to knock a bunch of buildings down, maybe a city block, something like that, all right? And then they decided to put it to the test, but first they asked the question among themselves, what is the possibility, since what we're doing here is we're starting a chain reaction, what's the possibility that this chain reaction will go beyond the explosive material itself and begin a chain reaction into the atmosphere and actually incinerate the entire atmosphere in the planet, right? And after some talk, and some people very concerned about that question, it came down to, we don't really think that that's a significant possibility. So they agreed to test. You know, it's like, oh, let's say 5% probability, 10% probability, something like that, that we're going to completely annihilate the planet when we test this bomb. So that's acceptable. So let's go ahead and do it. Because, you know, you've already done this. You've built this thing. So who's going to say no? And so nobody says no. And so here we have two ideas. Number one, it's not going to blow the planet up. And number two, it's going to be a big pop. Okay, this thing's going to go off with over 1,000 tons, maybe 2,000 tons TNT. So to set the whole thing up and everything, get ready to explode the bomb. And they do. They set it off. And the envelope of explosion grows and grows and grows. Now, remember, they're seeing it for the first time. You know, we've seen it on film, so we know what's going to happen, but they don't know what's going to happen. And this thing keeps growing and keeps growing. For about 5 minutes, it just keeps on growing. And at that point, Oppenheimer said, "We have become death." He's quoting from the Rig Veda. "We have become the destroyer of worlds." They thought at that point that they had messed up big time. Well, let's take care of the, you know, you won't have to sweat the Nazis anymore, you know. I'm just going to wipe out the whole planet right here, you know. The reason why they thought they were destroying the world there for those few minutes, and Oppenheimer said, "We were scared to death." And the reason why they thought they were was because they had misestimated what the power of the bomb was going to be. Turns out that it was not 1,500 tons TNT. It was 25,000 tons TNT, 2.5 megatons. All right. That's why the explosion was so huge. It was much bigger than they expected. Now, these are our scientists, our experts, and our great pragmatists at work right here. And their reason for doing this is because this will solve a problem, all right? Now, understand, by the time they set that bomb off, Germany's not a problem anymore. Japan is. So what do you do with the bomb? And they decided to use it on the Japanese. And they used it not once, but twice on the Japanese for the utilitarian purpose of saving American soldiers' lives. Okay? Now, setting the atom bomb off in Nagasaki and Hiroshima was not the worst damage that was done by American carpet bombing. Most of it was done by incendiary bombs before that took place. But do you see the mindset here? It's irrationality. You know, this is the use of pragmatism here. And it doesn't take things into account, because almost immediately after this takes place, knowledge of this bomb starts leaking into places where we don't want it going. As if, you know, we are responsible enough to hold this secret ourselves. It's now getting into the hands of people that are really irresponsible with this secret. And it's going to go on and on from there. A lot of those people on the Manhattan Project came out against nuclear, the use of nuclear weapons later on. Oppenheimer even gave some shake of the head towards, not having any nuclear weapons at all. However, Oppenheimer was extremely interested in what the outcome of this bomb was going to be once it was dropped on Japan. He wanted to know how did it look? And, you know, where were they? Was it nighttime when they did all this kind of stuff? All right. This is a pragmatic mindset. This is a raw, pragmatic mindset. There are no morals involved here. There are no ethics involved here. We have a problem. It needs to be solved. Let's do what it takes to solve it. And when that's done, we have done the right thing. Is there anybody, I know there are the no nuke crowd and all that kind of stuff, but how many people are asking the question about, some of the ways we conducted ourselves in World War II, carpet bombing, dropping atom bombs, things of this sort. How many people are asking the question, was that the right thing to do? Was that good? Was that manner of warfare good and right? Well, most of our historians and philosophers and so forth are looking back on that experience and saying, we got the job done. It worked. And so now we move on. And we move on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. Constantly verifying every experience that we've had as a civilization up to this point. This is what pragmatism does. Now, there are some people, there are some Christians who have a belief in what they call principled pragmatism. That is to say that if we use the tools of it and apply biblical principles to pragmatism, then we can do good things and the right things. The problem with that is that pragmatism is by nature unprincipled. There is no such thing as principled pragmatism. You can't have that. Once you begin to apply principles, you've ceased to work in pragmatism. Or let's put it this way, you have not added to the pragmatic tool chest. You have taken away from the principle, because the pragmatism is going to establish its own principle, not the one you're trying to train to it. All right. So we have to be careful in Christian political activism that we don't use the tools of the world. Because when we do that, it seems to make sense at first. But in the end, all we're really doing is abandoning the principle that we're trying to tag onto it. So we don't want to do that. Compromise is a very important part of pragmatism. Trying to find out how it is that dual principles or dual conditions can be brought into harmony with one another. We're back to the Tao now. And so the more that we explore that, the further and further that we get away. And remember what Hegel's saying, because Hegel is, with his synthesis, Hegel is basically drawing the line on the Tao. He's basically saying, here's where we want to be, right in here. We don't want to be on the black side or the white side. We want to be on that line right in between. And everything's going to continue to progress on that line in between. So pragmatism just grabs hold of Hegel's synthesis and just follows that on and on and on and on. And that's where we are. What do you get when you compromise? Well, most of the time what you get when you compromise is, I'll put it to you this way. All the time when you compromise, you get a loss. You don't gain anything. You lose. Whatever the totality is of two propositions, you're sacrificing out of each one of them in order to bring about a synthesis. And whenever that takes place, you've lost something. So what it is it is it's a mindset of loss, continual loss. And that fits in real nicely with our economic environment, right? Because every time we spend money, we're losing. Every time we use our credit card, we're losing. Every time we engage in commerce, we're losing something. Losing and losing and losing. And so it's a progress of just losing things. And I would propose that the age that we're living in right now is an age of just bare survival. Now, it doesn't look like that because everything looks so opulent around us and everything. You know, we've all got lots of stuff and live in a certain degree of comfort. But there's also a great emptiness that is in Americans today, and separation from one another, and a sort of a downward spiral. Everything starts somewhere and just begins to turn into that plodding walk as we go along. Jean-Paul Sartre said at the turn of the century, he said, if a true nihilist ever shows up, he will never know the philosophy of nihilism. And what he was saying there was, to understand this philosophy is to ascribe a meaning to a conversation. And the nihilist will never do that. He won't even know the conversation. You compare that to the products of what's coming out of the public school system today. You know, the young people who are, and I'm not saying all of them, not by any means, but the mass that's being turned out of the education system today. Can you even hold a conversation with them? You know, is there an ability to really reason things out? And where's the value systems there? Well, mostly turned into the internal self-aware me. And that in conjunction with some small tribe that I've become a part of that affirm me and I affirm them and so on. And this is the postmodern age that we're slipping into, an age of nihilism. All right. Now, I'm not blaming it on public school. I'm blaming it on a philosophy. And the philosophy is a philosophy of meaninglessness, which has been imbibed by the education systems ever since John Dewey. And now it's beginning to come to its end. You know, there are public school students who go through the experience and come out brilliant, and that's great. I'm glad for that. But my main point is this, this is what we've come to. We're arriving there. We're in that place now. Of a tribe of nihilists who don't even know they're nihilists, who believe in nothing and don't even know that there's anything, that there's any alternative to that. Okay. What do we do in this world? As Christians, what do we do? You know, I think that's almost self-evident. We have meaning. And we don't just have meaning. We have overflowing meaning. I mean, we have abundant meaning. We know purpose. God has purpose. And that's the one thing that we need to reteach the world. Purpose is not something that's going to be found in man. Man is not going to be the leader of his own destiny. Meaning is not something he can ascribe to himself. It's always going to be elusive to him, and eventually he'll lose it completely. Value. Man doesn't even know how to value himself, much less his fellow man, and all of the particulars of the environment of nature that he lives in. Only God can give those things, because he's the creator and he's the sovereign. And so what we need to do is we need to continue to do what the church has always done in the nihilistic ages that there has been in the past. And that is to know God's word, to preach God's word, to teach God's word, to disciple in God's word, to speak and converse in and argue God's word in season and out for the rest of our lives. The thing we don't want to do is to back away into an uncertain corner and keep our mouths shut. That's not what the world needs. You might say, yeah, but they'll hate me for it. Well, that's the price that's paid for the good of the world. That's the price that's paid. Jesus paid the price of being hated and murdered for the good and the salvation of the world. And as his disciples, we're called upon to be hated and disliked and marginalized for the good of the world. Because the world does not know what is best for itself. And so that's what we're here for. We're here to teach them what is best for themselves.